is SJR 18.
SJR 18.
Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We will start. We're unsure whether we're going to carry over Senate Bill 345. I think we probably will carry it over, but I won't do that officially yet. We will open a public hearing on SJR 18.
Madam Chairman, of the committee, SJR
18 comes to you from Senator Porzanski. Amends Section 10, Article 15 of the Constitution, State of Oregon, the Oregon Property Protection Act of 2000, by clarifying that the property forfeit constitutes the proceeds of the crime for which the claimant has been convicted. Two, was instrumental in committing or facilitating the crime for which the claimant has been convicted. Three, constitutes the proceeds of one or more other crimes similar to the crime for which the claimant was convicted. Four, was instrumental in committing or facilitating one or more of the other crimes similar to the crime for which the claimant was convicted. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chair, we have the dash three amendments in front of you. They combine the dash one and the dash three. The dash three came from Washington County concerning excluding animals from forfeiture that were abused or neglected or abandoned. And in the dash one, there was a similar provision. And I talked to Dave Hennis this morning, and he thought it would be best to combine the two and use the language from the dash three in the dash one as it relates to that topic.
No, wait. What are you saying? The dash three combines the dash one?
And the dash two.
Okay. And the dash two did what?
The dash two was
the dash two.
Dash two, Madam Chair, members of the committee, addressed the issue of forfeiture of an animal.
And what did the dash one do?
The dash one, I could walk through it, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What it does on page one of the bill, at the very end of line 29, it adds subsection four, forfeiture based on similar crimes. Sets forth whether the property may be forfeited in the paragraph C or D of the subsection 3 of the section only if the claimant is notified in writing of the other crime or crimes claimed to be similar to the crimes of which the claimant was convicted. Notice must be given at the time the claimant is given notice of the seizure of the property for forfeiture, and the claimant must have an opportunity to challenge the seizure and the forfeiture of the property. The next major change, Madam Chair, members of the committee, goes over to page 2 on line 2 when it adds after the words only, so the sentence would read, the property of the claimant who has not been convicted of a crime may be forfeited in the civil forfeiture proceedings only if, and then the inserted, the claimant consented to the forfeiture of the property or, and then it continues on. And then we go down to, line... over to page 3, where we delete the bold language on sections 3 through 11, and then further down on lines 28 through 32, where we delete subsection, currently subsection 8.
I don't see a section 3 through 11 on page 3.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would be lines 3 through 11.
Lines right 3 through 11. Got it. Okay.
And then on the same page, lines 28 through 32. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was brought to the amendments were a result of a work group involving law enforcement, the ACLU, the Department of Justice, and others.
Great. Thank you. Okay. We have three people signed up, so we'll bring them all up at once. Rob Bovet, Dave Fedanke, and Diana Vidalins.
Madam Chair, while they're coming forward, could I ask Council a question?
Absolutely.
I'm looking at the Hand and Gross version, and I see on page 2, line inserted line 14, some language added there, and I don't see that on this dash 3 amendments. This was Hand and Gross with the dash 1 amendments.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And that's where we were going to insert the issue as it relates to forfeited animals.
So this, the Hand and Gross thing is not...
That's correct, Madam Chair.
You'd have to look at the dash 2 to see the changes from the forfeited animals. Is that correct, Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the forfeited animals was both in the dash 1 and the dash 2. We could not have adopted both at the same time because for that particular provision, they conflicted as to where they were located in the draft and slightly in the language. So I talked to Dave Hendricks this morning about that. What he did was combine the two, and then into the dash three.
Okay, so we'll just have to get another hand and gross version at
correct.
Some point. Okay, welcome, everyone.
Madam Chair, Senators, Rob Ovette, Legal Counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, and here representing the Governor's Meth Task Force. We support Senate Joint Resolution 18 as well as the Dash 3 amendments, and I will keep my comments very brief. As Council reflected, we had a work group that worked on this bill to essentially, in part, conform Measure 3, which this is addressing, to essentially the deal we struck in 2005 when it was thought that a case that I had filed would strike down Measure 3. As it turns out, I lost my case by a vote of 3-3-1 at the Supreme Court, but nonetheless, I lost it. And so Measure 3 is still in the Constitution in its original form. And graciously, most of the same work group that worked on it in 2005 got back together and pragmatically addressed some of these issues, such as the animal issue that was never intended to be covered by Measure 3, some of the other unintended consequences. And we also added some more protections in terms of due process, notice, and hearing. And so we are pleased with the result of Senate Joint Resolution 18 and the Dash 3 amendments. And we also, just to let you know, the same work group is committed to working in the interim together with Dave Hendricks, who has graciously agreed to stay on until this is done, to essentially dramatically tune up and both ORS Chapter 475A, the civil forfeiture law, and the beginning sections of ORS Chapter 131, which is the criminal forfeiture law, to make sure we get out all the bugs out of the statutes as well. And we would propose, assuming that this passes, assuming that the voters approve these changes, we would propose to have the result of that work group be adopted possibly by the baby legislative session, the short legislative session, in the beginning of 08, but not go into effect unless the voters, of course, approve these changes.
So what you're saying is that a statutory measure like the one we passed at the end of the last session would be necessary in addition to this to accomplish what we tried to accomplish.
Madam Chair, that's essentially correct. As Mr. Fedanke will recall, he and I and a couple others sat down, I think it was the second to last day of the session, and worked out something really fast, and I think it was good work, but it needs some tune-up.
Yeah, well, that was excellent work under pressure, so I appreciate it. Okay, any questions of Mr. Bovette? Thanks. Dave, you want to go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And let me try to, I should say that the ACLU is, we are now at a point of being neutral on Senate Joint Resolution 18 with the Dash 3 amendments. And I'd like to ask a little bit of forbearance from the committee and try to put this in the context of where we've been on the civil forfeiture issue in Oregon. The original statute was approved back in 1989. There were a few changes that were made to it in 91 and 93. But there continued to be large disagreements over the policy underlying civil forfeitures in Oregon between some of us on the civil liberties side of the equation and law enforcement. And so a few of us came together in 1999, early 2000, and drafted what became Ballot Measure 3. Senator Przanski was very much involved in that effort and had been interested in civil forfeiture reform for quite some time. So that appeared on the ballot in the 2000 general election, was adopted by a sizable margin, passed in every county in the state of Oregon. This was not one of those issues where there was an urban-rural divide. And then Mr. Bovette's legal challenge started and wound its way through the courts based on the theory that Measure 3 was violated the separate vote requirement of the Oregon Constitution. And as Rob said, many of us close to this issue assumed the Oregon Supreme Court would toss Ballot Measure 3. And that was the context in which, at the very end of the 2005 legislative session, We finally sat down at the table and hammered out some compromises. At that time, I assured this committee, the 2005 version of this committee, that if Measure 3 were upheld, we would work in good faith with the supporters of House Bill 3457 to craft a constitutional amendment that reflected the decisions that had been embodied in that legislation, and that we would not oppose, that ACLU would not oppose such a constitutional amendment. And Senator Przanski, I will let him speak for himself in terms of his position on all this, but as you can see, he's the one who introduced SJR 18. And I believe he will say that he strongly supports it. So I have been working on behalf of those who supported ballot measure 3, including bringing in Michelle Burrows from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and also trying to consult with other interested parties who worked in support of Measure 3 to make sure that they are aware of SJR 18 and to make sure that their concerns are brought to the table. The bill in front of you, as it would be amended by the Dash 3 amendments, deals with most of the concerns of the Yes on Measure 3 coalition. The major policy issues in Measure 3 were, one, require a criminal conviction before final action could be taken to forfeit someone's property for criminal activity. Two, eliminate the actual or perceived conflict of interest that law enforcement agencies and forfeiture counsel may have had under the old law because they received virtually all of the proceeds from civil forfeitures. Now, there's great disagreement about whether there was any conflict of interest, but those of us who supported Measure 3 felt that there was. And so ballot Measure 3 would have prohibited the use of forfeiture proceeds, civil forfeiture proceeds, by law enforcement. House Bill 3457 and SJR 18, as it is before you, would allow law enforcement to get some of the proceeds from civil forfeitures, but the legislation that you approved last session also would have directed a significant chunk of funds towards drug court programs and relief nurseries to make sure that there would be a significant chunk of the money going towards drug treatment. There are a couple of issues around the edges that some of us who were involved in the coalition would like to see addressed in this legislation, but we are continuing to have discussions with folks in law enforcement about those concerns. We may have further amendments on the House side related to those issues, or we may just postpone those discussions until the interim when we deal with the implementing legislation, because there's nothing in this constitutional amendment that would prohibit those concerns being addressed in the statutory language. So all of that is a long-winded way of saying that ACLU is neutral on this legislation, and we will continue to work with supporters of this bill to fine-tune it, and we'll be working on the implementing legislation as well.
Thank you so much, and thanks for sticking with it and staying at the table. Sometimes when you get a court decision, the temptation is to just walk away and wash your hands of it and say we won, and I really appreciate your willingness to develop a system that will really work here and keep your promise from last session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue that I've been dealing with since 1985. Off and on, there is nothing I would like better than to reach some compromise that all the parties can live with so that I don't have to deal with it during every interim and every legislative session.
You're trying to argue self-interest, but I'm not buying it, Mr. Fedanke. And also, I wanted to encourage you on your willingness to do as much as you can through the statutory follow-up as opposed to loading down our Constitution, which has been a real problem with people trying to get too much into the Constitution when the statutory measure would work
better.
Thank you. Other questions, comments from the committee? Senator Brzezinski, did you want to add anything at this point?
Madam Chair, just that I am supporting SJR 18, as noted by Mr. Fidenke. Dave and I did serve on a group when Measure 3 was being drafted. All I will say is that, let's say, there was meeting of the minds on most of the issues. Some of them weren't, and the ones that went forward weren't necessarily everything I wanted, but I thought the protections that were provided to make certain before government takes someone's property based on alleged criminal activity that they needed to have a conviction, that's still there. And now what SJR 18 will in fact allow for is some of the proceeds to be used in law enforcement. I feel very comfortable that once you've had a judicial determination of guilt, that kind of is the buffer I needed to make certain. And so even though it may not have been the original Measure 3, it's here now. I definitely am supporting it as I would have if it would have been in Measure 3. But I also agree that I think what this work group did, and I want to acknowledge Dave and Rob for their hard work, because if you remember last session, I think the President gave me about 36 hours to see if we can get something together, and it's really those two gentlemen who actually got down to the nitty-gritty and put the stuff together for us to actually have a short-term fix. And as ACLU said that they would be willing to help pursue a fix if Measure 3 was upheld, I compliment them for, as you did, for them following through on that, and it was my intention to do the same, and so that's why we have what we have before us. I think that there's been enough work through this session for the work group to move the bill forward this time, understanding that when it goes over to the House side, there's probably some tweaking that may still need to happen. One of the issues that you'll be hearing about is animal forfeiture and some of the issues, and that hopefully we'll hear about the great bunny caper.
We heard a little bit about the animals, but we're looking forward to the money caper.
Well, it's Easter weekend.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great segue.
Okay, Ms. Vidalin, let's hear about the money caper here.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm here as a deputy district attorney from Crook County, and
can you identify yourself?
Dinah Vidalin, I apologize. And also as a representative of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. ODAA supports Senate Joint Resolution 18 with the Dash 3 amendments, and particularly the removal of animal forfeitures from SJR 18. And to tell you the bunny story quite briefly is that in Washington County, there were some rabbits seized that were severely abused and neglected. They're housed by the Humane Society there, and a proceeding was started to civilly forfeit those animals. I think it was a 3 to 4 day hearing, and the court found that, in fact, the bunnies had been neglected and abused and ordered them forfeited. And the defendant, who is also facing criminal charges, petitioned to the Supreme Court, and I understand that that was allowed. In the meantime, the defendant broke into the Humane Society place where they were keeping the rabbits, stole them, and she was then found traveling north on I-5 with the bunnies that she'd mixed together, so we don't know which bunnies are which, because they have had bunnies themselves now, and she had a goldfish in a bowl as well.
How many bunnies were we talking about?
200.
Bunny caper, not the bunny caper.
200.
About 200.
Bunny caper. And so now, currently, all of those rabbits are under armed 24-hour security in Washington County. And we're hoping that we don't have to do any more cases like that, because law enforcement cannot afford to seize and keep animals for that long. Thank you.
So this explains the mystery of why it was the Washington County lobbyist who came and proposed this amendment.
Yeah, that's correct.
Senator Brzezinski, did you have something to add?
I couldn't have said it any better. Diana was well enough to keep a straight face in telling you the great bunny caper. So, I mean, the reality, very serious. I mean, it is a situation that when you do have live beings that are in the middle of these processes, there needs to be a means to actually, let's say, expedite and take care of the issues as quickly as we can for health and safety and for just the financial burden and cost for this process. And when I was contacted about the need for that, I thought it was well worth it and something that we should address. Of course, those are the type of things, as we know, with any type of ballot measure, you try to see and hope that people, whoever put these together, will take everything in consideration. This is one of those areas, I think, that wasn't fully vet it and taken care of, and now we have the opportunity to do so.
That's great. Well, this is,
Madam Chair, just real briefly, and Senator Brzezinski, Dave reminded me that back in 1995, I actually helped write a statute, ORS 167-347. So by exempting animal abuse and neglect from this, that doesn't mean we don't have a process and a procedure and protections. 167-347 is kind of the process you talked about, and it provides those protections in statute.
Correct. Okay, that's good. Get on the record. Any other questions or comments, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. First off, in paragraph one, why are we changing, it'd be line 19 and 20, why are we changing from owner of to person claiming?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, because in a civil forfeiture proceeding, which is, and let me see if I can put this in English since I'm the non-lawyer among the group here. Civil forfeitures are in rem proceedings that are filed against the property itself, as opposed to a proceeding against the owner of the property. So the government sues the property itself for forfeiture. And then in order for someone who has a property interest in that property, maybe an owner, maybe a lien holder, could be a financial institution. They have to file a claim with the government. They become a claimant. So I think this was an attempt by LC to try to conform the Constitution with the way these things are handled in statute, whereas when some of us were sitting around a table drafting Measure 3 the first time around, we just use the term owner, which is not a legal term of art.
Okay. And also, just for clarification, because everybody's talked about the threes, are we considering the twos and threes or just the threes?
Just the threes.
Just the threes.
Okay. Did you have anything else to add? Okay. Any other? Senator Walker, did you have a question?
No, I did not. Just be happy too when we get Measure 3 resolved.
Good. Any other questions, comments? Senator Beyer, you look perplexed. Okay. Thank you very much. It is my intention to move this bill. I just want to take extra special care to read over the dash threes and make sure everything does what it's supposed to, and would ask for Senator Brzezinski's help and anyone else's help to really go through every line and make sure it does exactly what we think, since this is a constitutional amendment. But for now, I will close the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 18 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 732. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 732 relates to the administration of polygraph examinations to applicants for the position of police officer or reserve police officer. ORS 659A.300 prohibits employers from subjecting employees or prospective employees to breath test, polygraph test, psychological stress test, genetic test, or brainwave test. There are certain exceptions if the employee consents. Similarly, ORS 659.840 prohibits employers from requiring employees or prospective employees to take breath tests, polygraph tests, or any other form of, quote, lie detector test. And there is also the same exception for employees who will consent in certain circumstances. There is difficult to articulate much of a difference between ORS 659A and ORS 659. ORS 659 was enacted originally in 1963, ORS 659A enacted originally in 1979. Both statutory provisions have the same rule. An employer can't subject employees to certain tests, but then they carve out exceptions for consent. That's really the only other difference that I can see between 659 and 659A is that 659A has a specific statutory right of action for violations of its provisions. But in any event, what Senate Bill 732 does is it creates an additional exception to the prohibitions on requiring employees or prospective employees to take certain tests. Senate Bill 732 creates an exception. It allows the administration of a polygraph test to individuals applying to be police officers or reserve police officers. However, it specifies that the applicant may not be disqualified solely on the basis of the polygraph results, and that such an action, disqualification based solely on polygraph results, would constitute an unlawful employment practice. And it makes these, and it enacts these provisions both into Chapter 659A and into Chapter 659.
Okie dokie. We have Rosie Sizer and Kevin Campbell signed up here. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to speak in favor of Senate Bill 732. As counsel already mentioned, the purpose of this bill was to allow polygraph for pre-employment for police officers and reserve officers with the additional element that it could not be used as a sole basis for disqualifying a candidate from a position. And the purpose of the bill, we had a number of agencies from throughout the state that have requested that we move forward with this bill. Several of them have specific examples of problems that have occurred in the hiring process because of a hire that later turned out to be a problem that perhaps could have been avoided through the use of something or a tool like the polygraph. The purpose is to protect the public, frankly, and to guard carefully the honor of law enforcement profession and the police officers, the good ones that choose to serve every day, which is like 99.99% of all police officers. And you're all aware, as you've watched the TV series, like those dealing with the tarnished badge series, the really bad police officers end up defining the profession. And in a number of these cases, these folks would have potentially been prohibited from moving forward in the hiring process through the use of a tool like the polygraph. This bill is not designed to replace all of the current background that goes on in the hiring process. It's to add an element that is, in fact, used in a number of other states. I was discussing this bill with a former police chief from the city of Bend, Dave Malkin. He was the chief there for 17 years, who just recalled one example of a hiring situation that he had where the two finalists he had for a position, he found out that both had failed polygraphs in other states, one in Washington, one in California. And, of course, Oregon didn't have the practice, but had he not found out about that, both of these candidates would have gone into the law enforcement profession. He had no access to that tool and would not have found that out in any other way. So I provided in my testimony additional information about the polygraph itself and how it is utilized within the hiring process. It is to us an important tool, and it will give us an opportunity to protect the integrity of the profession by allowing agencies to do this. It is a may and not a shall. We did that on purpose. But we do have surrounding states that require this, use polygraphs for pre-employment. Some states require it, like Arizona, and we prefer not to be the dumping ground for candidates that can't be hired in other states because we can't have the authorization to use the polygraph. So with that, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I will turn things over to Chief Sizer.
Before you do, you mentioned the situation in Bend, and you also mentioned that in the bill it can't be the sole basis, but it sounds to me like the flunking the polygraph was the sole basis for not hiring these two people.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I do not have the detailed information about everything that went on in that hiring process, nor do I know when he found out about that. I know they were in the final process, so there could have been any number of things. For the purpose of this bill, the polygraph is not allowed to be the sole basis for disqualification. So I also don't know how he even found out about this. So this is probably not common practice, and I'm not sure that you even find out about this. So my purpose for sharing it is not to create an expectation that we call around to find out if people fail polygraphs, and I'm not even sure if that information is available, and I don't know how he found out about it. But the point is that in this case, given the information that was found out, they did fail the polygraphs, And in the testimony, I pointed out a little more specificity what it involved. That's a pretty significant problem. I mean, embezzlement, stealing, for a police officer is not an acceptable history or behavior. And so my point in bringing that out is that he would have had no other way of knowing that particular thing because it wouldn't have been found out in a background check or other typical methods for checking background. So.
Okay, Chief Sizer.
Good afternoon. I'm Rosie Sizer, and I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Portland, and I, too, am speaking in favor of Senate Bill 732. And as Kevin said, that it removes the current prohibition in state law on using polygraph exam for pre-employment screening for applicants for police officer and police reserve positions. Along with Michigan, Oregon is one of only two states that prohibits the use of polygraph exams as an instrument of, to assist police agencies in screening applicants. Neither this bill nor similar bills in some other states requires police agencies to use the polygraph exam in their pre-employment screening. So I think it's key that only one other state, the state of Michigan, actually prohibits it. Most importantly, we believe that the polygraph exam will help us to determine whether applicants are becoming are being forthright and truthful about answers in their background investigations related to theft, drug use, lying, domestic violence, and prohibited sexual conduct in ORS. Typically, a Portland police hiring process takes from 9 to 12 months. It's an extensive process that includes a written and oral exam, a thorough background investigation, medical and psychological exams. A polygraph would not supplant any of those hiring tools. It would simply supplement them. We think the change in the law would increase the numbers of people who self-screen out of the application process if they have really problematic backgrounds. We believe it will reduce the number of applicants who intentionally withhold negative information. And we have repeated instances where people are deceptive in their background interviews about things that if they had only told us up front would not have prevented them from being police officer, but it's the act of deception that is the problem in the hiring process. We believe it may help us reduce the time needed to complete background investigations as it would help us identify areas that should be more specifically probed. We hope to increase the number of cases background investigators are able to process to hire, and it will provide an additional tool to examine veracity of candidates' background information. Polygraph exams would ideally be administered at the front end of the hiring process, but timing would be, of course, determined by the individual agency. At the front end, it might be more expensive, but it may streamline the process. Polygraph exams are not panaceas. Evidence suggests that there are people who can beat a polygraph exam. However, I think it's a reasonable measure that has been adopted by states across the nation because of the nature and of authority of police officers. There's no issue more important to any police agency than the issue of public trust. Unfortunately, in recent years, the entire profession has received a black eye from the behavior of a few of its members. My hope and expectation is that the polygraph exam will be a tool in preventing people with deeply concealed problematic backgrounds from becoming police officers. For the rest of us who have not all led entirely blameless lives, it will help us upon hire to be more forthcoming and to take responsibility for actions setting a tone for the rest of our careers. And if I might just follow up with, most police agencies, when they are involved in hiring an applicant, ask applicants where they have attempted to be hired. And that's a question that they need to be truthful about. People reveal that they've applied for various agencies. Our agencies then call those agencies. They will find whether or not, if there was a polygraph, someone passed or failed, and then what a background investigator from that agency was able to verify that was problematic. Sometimes lying, sometimes theft, sometimes drug use. And that police agencies tend to be very forthcoming with each other about the results of their backgrounds and will actually ship a background investigation to another agency.
How do you deal with the issue of false positives? Like somebody looks like they're lying, but they're not in fact lying. Do you think it's fair that they should be denied employment just because they...
Well, they will not be denied employment unless we're able to otherwise verify through the background process whatever the issue was in the polygraph exam actually existed. That could come from re-interviewing the applicant. It could come from probing more deeply into references, other employment references, character references. If we're not able to verify an issue that might have been flagged by the polygraph, then the person is likely to be hired.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, currently when you hire, you do extensive background checks. I mean, you check into all sorts of things. Like you said, it's a long process, very detailed. As I see the addition of polygraph, basically it's to find out if they were being truthful or not in what they have given you. I guess what I'm wondering is, because the way this is written, it can't be used as the sole means, but it might be the driver for not employing the person. I'm wondering if you're potentially setting up something that's actionable by using that information. I mean, because they could claim at that point, well, you know, the background check was clean and this drove them to do that, so they're using the polygraph to not hire me, and then they sue you for not hiring them. I don't know if that's a potential reality or not.
Chair Senator Cruz, I'm sorry I didn't address you properly formally.
Oh, no problem.
But I guess police agencies are used to being sued. We are often sued. We are sued for any manner of things. Potentially, we can be sued now for not hiring somebody.
For a lot of reasons, I'm sure.
There's any myriad of reasons why people sue a police agency. That's a risk that I'm willing to take to improve the quality of employees we have in the profession. How this would actually work is we have a statement of personal history that each applicant is required to submit at the point at which we begin a background process. Ideally, we would take the statement of personal history and use it to help frame questions during the polygraph exam. The polygraph exam would then give us areas we might be most concerned about, not that somebody is truthful or not truthful, but whether or not they appear to be deceptive. And it would give us, in addition to the normal processes that we do, areas that we might want to key on and really look at more closely, or time periods that we might want to key on and look at more closely.
I'm sure
Tom, just follow up.
I was going to just follow up on
that point.
That.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the thing is that you wouldn't see this test being given at the end of this process. Instead, it would be the earlier part. Once they've filled out the forms, they're going to walk them through it because you wouldn't want to be sending your investigators out two or three times as compared to having this in the framework. And I would assume it would be early on in the process to give them these areas that they would want their investigator to be looking at.
Yeah.
So I would be concerned as well, Senator, if it was like the last test or last part of the application process is take a lie detector test, and then all of a sudden we got something new. I would expect that they're going to do this early on in the process to flesh out any areas that they want their background people to be looking at.
And then, if it might help at all, I have a number of employees in the Portland Police Bureau who have been police officers in other states and have gone through polygraph exams and other background investigations. And for the most part, they report to me, or they all report to me, those who I've talked to, that it is rigorous, that it feels fair, and they feel that it sets a tone about being forthcoming with all their information, and they feel it's a good thing for the profession that you start a job that is so involved in public trust in that manner.
Well,
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. So, obviously, from your testimony, if we enact this bill, you will be doing it.
Yes. As police chief, I would ensure that.
You would have that authority, I would think. And so I would assume because it's permissive, you wouldn't envision any law enforcement agency, if they're doing it, it would be uniform. It wouldn't be selective, I'm assuming. In other words, all applicants, okay. And is there some sort of standard form of questions, or would in the states that are currently doing it now, is there a standard form, the questions they ask, or do they just kind of go off the cuff on that sort of thing?
Well, what I've been told is that the profession of polygraph examiners are reluctant to give us the list of questions because they don't want people to use that information to beat the exams. But there is consistency between exams.
Okay, and would you be asking people to verify their educational level on these polygraphs? Senator Walker.
I don't have a note about that. I listen to Kink Radio in the morning when I wake up, and I hear people are a little upset about some recommended change that you have.
And it's been a fascinating discussion, and people have been all over. People with varying educational levels and backgrounds themselves have been all over the map on it. It's been absolutely fascinating.
And for the record, you have not made up your mind yet.
I haven't made up my mind.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, Portland's like Eugene, and if you don't have something controversial to talk about, it's not very interesting. So, this is your current controversial issue. So.
One of many.
You're not the only People's Republic Senator.
No, Walker. And we have our police chief here, too, to tell us about what we do in our city. So,
okay. Other questions from the committee?
Or a captain.
Are there questions?
That's close enough.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Alex.
Tyler
and Steve Swenson from the city of Eugene.
Yeah. Senator Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst with the City of Eugene. We are in favor of Senate Bill 732. The documents that we're passing out today, and with me today is Captain Steve Swenson of the Eugene Police Department. He'll be testifying after I am through. But I wanted to let you know that one of the documents we're passing out here is a letter from a vendor who provides psychological stress testing for the city, and I just wanted to
I think to speak to the previous testimony, there's an interesting item here under bullet four of the letter. When applicants know they will face a polygraph in the selection system, they're more honest at all stages of the selection process. And I think that's a worthwhile thing to note, that applicants, if they understand that there is a polygraph as part of that selection process, will be more forthcoming in all of the areas of that process. And Senator Walker, you might find the list of kind of questions that they've got some data on the third page of this document, so you can see sort of some of the things where the polygraph has made a difference in terms of the questions that are asked and their the responses to those. I have no further testimony, and at this point would turn it over to Captain Svensson.
Before you do that, well, maybe I'll wait until the captain testifies, because that might be more questions for him. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, other members of the committee. My name is Steve Svensson. I'm the captain with Eugene Police Department. Thank you for the promotion, Senator Walker.
I know. Chief.
Hopefully that won't precede me back, Eugene.
It's sometimes already people there. Come in here and call her your honor, so we all sort of lose track of our titles when we're in.
I appreciate
the thought. Makes my day, I'll tell you.
I'm a 30-year member of law enforcement, and my current role, I'm the captain of operations support, which includes managing our hiring processes, managing our police academy, and our internal affairs. All of those have ties to this bill. I also have the distinct experience of starting my career in a state in California, El Cajon Police Department, where polygraph exams were administered as part of the pre-employment process. It's as clear as though it happened yesterday. I can still remember that experience, and I would echo the comments of those who spoke to Chief Sizer earlier, that it does improve the quality of your hiring process. In law enforcement, we're struggling with our reputation. We talk about the thin blue line that protects the good people from the bad people, and you want that thin blue line to consist of the good people. We live in a time of situational ethics, where little lies can become big lies depending on what the issues are and what's at stake. And law enforcement is one of the professions where there's an expectation by the public that our ethics are as impeccable as any that can be found. We recognize that people are not flawless. We hire from the general population. We're not hiring from the convents and the monasteries. We're looking for people who have life experiences. But we also find that not everyone is suitable for this line of work. For us, public trust is paramount to doing our jobs, and having people that can uphold that trust is very important. Probably the most important component of finding those people is our hiring and selection processes. We can teach people the skills, the motor skills, the qualities that we look for in police officers, but our applicants have to bring some things to the job, and that's their integrity, their honesty, their work ethic, and those areas we can't give to them. They have to give us that when they show up. We have a lot of processes in place to help us make good selections. We utilize very good testing, written testing. We use very good interview techniques. We do personal history questionnaires where they self-disclose their flaws and their good points. We utilize the law enforcement psychological services, which is not psychological stress testing. It's psychologists that analyze various psychological tests, MMPIs, and various other types. They do interviews on the folks. They look at our backgrounds and make determinations of what to ask based on those. What is clearly missing in that component is the part that we're not able to find out through backgrounds. We can only find out in backgrounds what a person is willing to self-disclose or what we can find out from other people who are willing to share that information with us. But the part about what you know that you haven't told someone or that your friend or your family is not willing to disclose will often go unnoticed or uncovered. The polygraph is a way of bringing those things forth. You know what you know. And just reflecting on my personal experience, when they tell you that you're going to get a polygraph and we're going to generally ask you about drug use, theft, honesty, sexual deviancy, have you had forcible sex with a person, you have about a week or two to think about those things. And believe me, you start remembering every little thing that you have done in your life, and it comes up in the polygraph. And for us, it's not a matter of finding folks who have never done anything wrong in their life. It's a matter of knowing what it is that they've done and that they've been truthful about it. In mine, I disclosed that I swiped a watermelon from my neighbor's watermelon patch because I'd forgotten about it, but the more I started thinking about it, I knew it was going to come up. So that's how detailed and how thin you can go down into a person's internal memory. Nobody knew that, but I was able to disclose that. The people that got the results of my polygraph knew that, well, that's as bad as it gets with him. And that was something they were very comfortable with, making that hiring decision based upon, that's the worst that he's done? Okay, we can live with that. We want to make informed decisions about people when we hire them. And I heard a question earlier about, well, if they don't pass the polygraph, coming from a place where people are familiar with that term, that can mean one of two things. It can mean that you lied and you were so deceptive on the polygraph that it shows that you were untruthful. That would be a true failing the polygraph. A lesser version of that, but I think which is commonly lumped into that same role, is that during the polygraph you showed some signs of deception. They followed up. The polygrapher, a trained polygrapher, will follow up and say something like, well, under the area of drug use, you already disclosed that you have done this, but you are still showing some signs of deception. Are there other things? And that is an opportunity for the person to say, well, yeah, in addition to what I told you about, I have also done this. Those disclosures can sometimes in themselves be disclosing disqualifying information. So a person could fail the polygraph based upon what came out during that. And if a person discloses information that would otherwise disqualify them in the process, that could disqualify them. But it wouldn't be from a perception of deception based on the polygraph. Because there are some things that can make you very nervous that will show up on a polygraph that requires some additional follow-up. But it's not you don't fail it that way, per se.
What happens to a person, and this may go beyond your level of expertise, that if a person like has driven after using drugs, for example, so I take some Advil and drive down to the store or something, and so literally speaking, I've driven after taking some drugs, so I answer yes on the polygraph. If someone basically makes themselves look worse than they are, does the polygraph pick that up?
Well, what they would do in that circumstance, if you said, well, I've taken Advil and then I drove, the polygrapher would say, other than the time that you took Advil and then drove, have you driven while under the influence of drugs or after having taken drugs? Or they can ask the question, after having used illegal drugs, they can differentiate between prescription and illegal. They go over the questions with you before they put you on the box, before they put you on the polygraph, to give you an opportunity to explain it. So then they ask you questions other than what you've said, or other than the time you stole the watermelon, have you committed any other acts of theft? Those types of things.
So then you kind of scour your brain and come up with what you can come up with, and
yes,
it works. Okay. All right. Questions from the committee? Senator Walker.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Mr. Kyler gave us these, I think you gave us these examples of questions that you ask on a polygraph. I was just kind of curious why some of these are asked. What difference does it make if someone was referred to a collection agency, declared bankruptcy, or ever received workers' compensation? Why are those issues asked?
I can address those in general terms. After having worked in law enforcement for as long as I have, what used to be a concern years ago is not as big of an issue as it once was. If you had ever declared bankruptcy 30 years ago, you wouldn't be hired as a police officer because they were so concerned about your ability to manage your affairs that, you know, you'd be susceptible to bribery or to taking money. What we recognize in the changing world is it's not unusual for people coming into our profession to be $10,000 in debt from credit card debt because they have them now. Circumstances have changed. But I know in general terms, when they ask those types of questions, they're asking to ascertain if people have gotten themselves into problems that they're not disclosing to us, such as deep financial issues. Have they ever had to steal money? Have they ever had to falsify records to get more money or to do things like that? So it's again, I'm not the expert on polygraphs, but those are the kinds of areas that they're looking at about self-disclosure, drug use, and those types of areas.
Well, I'm still concerned about the workers' comp issue. Is that, are you going to disqualify someone because they've had a workers' comp claim?
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, when we spoke to another analyst at Eugene Police Department prior to the session, and this was one of their priority bills, we did have a brief conversation with them about this kind of testing. And some of the things that he talked about was the exposure to areas where an individual might be susceptible to, for instance, would they be, if they have had some financial troubles, does that make them susceptible in their job to a situation where if they're exposed to, say, property or evidence, you know, is that if there was a large amount of cash or something, does that make them somehow susceptible to, you know, if they have some money issues, do they need to
What about the workers' comp issue?
That workers' comp didn't come up specifically in our conversation, so I can't answer that, but I recall now in terms of the, you know, some of those financial questions, that the question of susceptibility did come forward.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Thank you. It appears that these questions come from a pre-employment application personal history questionnaire developed by Johnson Roberts and Associates. Is that the intent of police agencies to utilize an existing questionnaire by some company such as this that's designed for police officers?
Senator Burke, Senator Walker, we do use the personal history questionnaire that this outfit utilizes. It gives us some direction to look as we do our backgrounds as far as what are some of the areas that they have self-disclosed that we should answer further. If a person has disclosed in their personal history questionnaire that they have committed a theft of an item over $25, we ask for additional information to clarify the circumstances around that. And try to address that. You know, I'm speculating here, but I've been doing the backgrounds and the hiring processes for a long time. I could see the nexus between asking about a workman's comp history of asking the question on a polygraph, have you ever falsified a workman's comp claim as an opportunity for deception or to show that they're being honest? I don't have first-hand experience with that one, but just working in that realm, that would be my informed guess about what that would be.
Well, but that also raises issues. Are you trying to uncover if somebody has a disability?
That's
no,
question.
No. There are without going into the whole hiring process, the polygraph is not designed to outline a disability, and I don't think a polygrapher could frame a question that would be legal that would ask them to disclose a disability. I think that would be unethical for them.
Workers' comp would be a place to start.
I think disclosing whether you have, if a person has ever filed a false workman's comp claim or exaggerated a claim for the purposes of obtaining benefits, would be the type of information that would appear to be what would be helpful to us, not the fact that they've had a workman's comp claim. We find out in backgrounds that people use sick time or whatever. We make it a point to avoid going into FMLA time and protected time and why did they use sick time, things like that. So that would be taking the tool far afield of where it was intended. It's used as a way to determine whether a person is being truthful and honest in a very specific set of areas around integrity, around drug use, around sexual misconduct. It's not, as an example, you would not use this to say, is this person gay? That would not be an appropriate line of questioning. But to say, have you ever had sexual relations, illegal sexual relations with a person under the age of 18 when you were an adult? Those would be areas that we would be very interested in knowing. Have you engaged in the services of prostitutes? Those would be areas that would be relevant to their suitability as a police officer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pisanski.
Captain, regarding other types of testing or stuff that's done within this application process, clearly they go through some type of physical stress type of testing to determine whether they're physically fit to do the job.
Yeah. Senator Pisanski, we do have a police officer's physical ability test, which is, for lack of a better term, a fitness test that tests their strength to respond to a problem, to deal with the problem, and to do some basic job applicable skills such as being able to lift, drag, engage in a simulated struggle where they're struggling with certain amounts of weight and a certain amount of endurance going up and down stairs and running a relatively short distance. That is part of the entry-level test.
I would also assume that that would require such as having the full, say, tool kit attached to their body so they have different weight. I mean, what I'm getting at, I guess, is that the stress top analysis, that if someone had an issue that may have caused them to have a workers' comp claim or something like that, those things are going to be probably borne out through their ability to do these physical fitness or agility tests under whatever scenarios that they may have to act out in or act with out in the field.
Well, they actually perform the test in gym clothing, so they're not wearing a gun belt or anything like that. We do, as part of our pre-hire standards, require that a person, it's one of the very last processes to go through a medical exam. There are some disclosures that are asked for in the medical exam about backs and various things like that. Are there any things that would preclude you from performing the bona fide occupational requirements of a police officer? And the examining physicians have those listings.
But you don't polygraph. Yes. You wouldn't polygraph on those questions,
no,
would you?
Not at all.
Okay. So I'm assuming that the polygraph, if you use kind of a standardized form, there are questions that are not legal to ask. You can't ask someone about their marital status or...
have they ever cheated on their wife?
Yeah, well, no, I mean a protected class, age. There are protected classes, illegal questions that you can't ask. Hopefully there'll be more illegal questions by the time this session is over. But I'm assuming that the polygraph would have the same constraints against those questions as you would.
Yes,
just
ma'am.
Plain asking them.
If I can add one thing, the city of Eugene went through a very high-profile, very painful process where we had two officers that engaged in extreme misconduct. One's doing 94 years in prison, and the other one did several and is now out. As a result of that process, we had a number of reviews, internal reviews, external reviews, one of which was conducted by the Police Executive Research Forum and the International City County Managers Association, also known as PERF ICMA. They made an extensive list of recommendations to us to help us improve processes that allowed these two individuals to be hired. I played a key role in implementing those processes in the last 3 years, and I have to say that our hiring processes have improved considerably because of that. One recommendation that PERF ICMA made that we have not been able to implement is the use of polygraph examinations. And as Dr. Roberts indicated in his letter, those two individuals, Magana and Laura, would not have been hired had the things that came to light as a result of their criminal misconduct, had those been disclosed as part of a polygraph. We didn't catch them in the background. It would have come out in a polygraph, and those people wouldn't have had the opportunity to do the things that they did. It makes it real clear, and I kind of started the conversation with you, that knowing that it's coming tends to make a person more honest and more forthcoming, knowing that their failure to disclose will show up, and that failure to disclose can be disqualifying for us. We find out things in backgrounds that, had they disclosed them, they would not have disqualified them. But the fact that they intentionally hid them from us can disqualify them from further consideration because of the honesty factor.
Okay. Other questions?
Just one. I was wondering, Captain, whether this had come out of that work group that, as a result of the two offending police officers. My question is, if we were to pass this legislation, would you be telling applicants at the time of application that they will be subject to a polygraph, because they need to know that so that they can answer their questionnaire appropriately?
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, absolutely. In our current hiring processes, we lay it out in the application what the testing processes consist of, and they know that there's written tests, physical testing, backgrounds, medical. We would include polygraph in that definition.
So I don't know, Madam Chair, follow-up. I don't know how many people currently pick up an application and look at what you're going to do and then decide not to follow through. But if we were to implement polygraphs, you might see even more of them that decide to put it back down and go look for other work, I suspect.
And hiring is a very expensive process. And if this is going to add some cost, but it's cheaper to do 5 polygraphs than it is to have an extra hiring process because you're not picking these things up. If people just self-deselect because of that, that would be a good thing for us.
Chief Sizer did indicate that the hiring process in Portland was 9 to 12 months long. That's a long time. Is that how long you take?
I thought ours was long. Ours is 6.
We do things differently in Portland. Captain, I wanted to also ask you, Chief Sizer said that the intention in Portland would be to give all applicants this polygraph at the front end. And I wanted to find out if that was your intention first and if you'd see any problem with making that a provision of being able to use this authority, that every applicant is, number one, informed about it, and number two, that it's at the front end of the process.
We require that every police officer applicant, whether they are brand new, never been a police officer, or one who comes from another state that's already qualified, go through the same hiring process. That would include a polygraph. If it was required for one, it would be required for all. I can't definitively speak at this point as to where in the process it would be placed, but I would hope that we do it earlier on than later on. There are several distinctive points in the process where it could fit. If Chief Sizer is inclined to do it at the front end for Portland, we would certainly take a look at that. I agree with what Senator Przanski said. I believe it was Senator earlier that said you don't want to have it at the tail end and then have to go back and reinvestigate things that were disclosed. But somewhere in that realm of after the pre-screen questionnaire, possibly before the interview with the psychologist, either immediately preceding the background or immediately after the background, but while that still is a viable process. We get into all kinds of little hiring law unique areas. Once you pass a background phase of the hiring, we typically have our psychologist interview them. If the psychologist finds out things in talking to them that should have come out in the background, unless they are disqualifying, we can't go back and reopen the background. There was some case law around that. So we have to be very careful about where we place certain things so that we don't lose the ability and the flexibility to investigate further. So the short answer to my very long answer is that I'm not sure where it would go in the process, but it would be placed at a point where it would be the most useful to us in using it as part of the hiring tool.
But it's fair to say that everybody who was hired would have to go through it at some point or another.
Yes, ma'am.
You wouldn't just parse out the people you...
No, we wouldn't give it to some based, you know, we heard this, so let's go ahead and give this person a polygraph, but this person looks good, so let's not bother. Everyone at a certain point in the process that was successful to that point would have to undergo the polygraph.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Andrea, are you ready yet? Andrea Meyer and Brian DeLashmet.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 732. I'm handing you an executive summary from the National Academies of Science, a part of their book, The Polygraph and Lie Detection, that was published in 2004. And the committee was set up to review scientific evidence of polygraphs, and my testimony will almost entirely consist of portions, excerpts of that, unless otherwise noted. They explain that polygraphs are used for three main purposes: event-specific investigations after a crime, employee screening, or pre-employment screening. For employee screening, there is no specific event being investigated. It's difficult for both the examinee and the examiner to know whether an answer to such a question is truthful unless there are clear and consistent criteria that specify what activities justify a yes answer. Examinees may believe they are lying when providing factually truthful responses, or vice versa. Pre-employment screening, which is what we're speaking of here, is even more complicated because it involves inferences about future behavior on the basis of information about past behaviors. The committee reviewing this has not seen a clear and stable agreement on the criteria for judging answers. But the committee was charged specifically to conduct scientific review of polygraph research as it pertains to validity and reliability. And they said virtually all available scientific evidence on polygraph test validity comes from studies of specific event investigations. And the substantial majority of the studies were below the quality level typically needed for funding by the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health. almost a century of research they wrote in scientific psychology and physiology provides little basis for the expectation that a polygraph test could have extremely high accuracy. Most psychological and physiological factors, such as anxiety about being tested, affect responses. It makes polygraph testing intrinsically susceptible to producing erroneous results. This inherent ambiguity of the physiological measures used in polygraphs suggests that further investments in improving polygraph technique and interpretation will bring only modest improvement in accuracy. We found alarming the following statement, that there was evidence suggesting that truthful members of socially stigmatized groups and truthful examinees who are believed to be guilty or believed to have a high likelihood of being guilty may show emotional or physiological responses in polygraph test situations that mimic responses that are expected of deceptive individuals. Scientific evidence relevant to accuracy for employee and pre-employment screening is extremely limited. Only one field study, they wrote, which is flawed, provides evidence relevant to the accuracy of pre-employment screening. Of the 57 studies the committees used, most fell short of what is desirable, and accuracy higher than actual the studies provided an accuracy higher than actual specific incident testing in the field. And field studies have major problems, they said, with identifying the truth against which test results should be judged. Most of these studies involve specific incidences, typically mock crimes, and lab studies suffer from a lack of realism. Now, there has been discussion that the type of questions are sort of these controlled question techniques, that they get the questions. I now quote from a 1998 U.S. Supreme Court decision, United States versus Sheffer, where they note in use of polygraphs, and the case had to do with whether the defendant in a military, under the military code rule of evidence, could bring in his use of polygraph information. The court said, no, the code of evidence says you cannot. And in analyzing the current status a year, 10 years ago on the study, it said, the scientific field suggests the accuracy rate of the control question technique, polygraph, is little better than could be obtained by the toss of a coin. That is 50%. And they cite, the Supreme Court cites the study for that basis. Now, I just want to draw your attention to page 5 of the material I've given you. And it's a table. And I want to go over this table briefly. It's the results of a polygraph test if you were examining a population of 10,000 looking for 10 spies. The first table is based on if it was 80% accurate. The spies, 8 out of the 10 would fail the test. You'd catch them. But you'd also sweep in almost 1,600 individuals as spies who are not. Now, if you if the tests were set to reduce the number of these false alarms, that's the second table, and that's a 99.5% accuracy. So now you only catch 2 of the 10 spies by reducing the number from 1,600 to 39 of people who are innocent who are caught into it. That is what we found in the study and very alarming. I want to address a few issues that were brought up in testimony. There was a good deal of discussion about at what stage the test would occur in pre-employment, at the beginning or at the end. I noted that Mr. Campbell had provided in his written testimony that in order to avoid conflicts with the ADA, the examinations are usually given post-offer in the early stages of a probationary period, but we got different information about when it would occur. Senator Cruz mentioned it, if it's not the sole basis, but it's after the job, how would it not be the basis after the job is offered? And I agree that raises concerns. Chief Sizer
said that we will verify the truth of the statements. And if we're unable to verify, if someone appears to be deceptive, they can be hired. Well, that seems counter to a lot of the discussion, but I'd raise if someone appears deceptive about that they stole, as the anecdotal example earlier on, how is that going to be verified if it's stealing from the employer and the employer never knew? So it's not, we are told, used to determine employment, and indeed the bill suggests that it can't be the only basis, that it would be an unlawful employment practice, but all the testimony we've heard today suggests that it really will be. Either you're getting information that disqualifies someone, or they're showing sufficient deceptiveness and that they're therefore a liar, and that's a basis for disqualifying. So I think the language in the bill saying it wouldn't be a disqualifying is troubling and not accurate. But more importantly, as I close, we think the evidence and the studies show that these tests are not reliable, are sufficiently alarming to us, seem to select out socially stigmatized groups for disproportionate reactions, and we would urge you not to move forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Delaschmidt.
For the record, Brian Delaschmidt, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, the last two, primarily because I can see this bill, if it were to pass, to be expanded to a whole variety of other law enforcement or peace officer status, and they have concerns as well. So all four are opposed to the bill. You've heard some testimony. Actually, my colleague and friend from the ACLU has done a pretty good job about the reliability of different levels of polygraph when they're used at different stages, whether it's related to a crime after the fact, or whether it's in employment or pre-employment. And I won't spend a lot of time on that. I was going to touch a little bit on that. But in my discussions with my representatives or my members, they tend to ask them, I said, okay, what is the value of polygraph from your perspective? And they said, well, in most cases, when it's used in a criminal proceeding, if in fact they proceed with a polygraph, it's not to verify the accuracy or inaccuracy of someone's statement. It is more a tool to, in fact, extract a confession. That in fact the work that's done in asking the questions is a tool to help break somebody and get some information out of them that obviously would have not otherwise divulged, but in fact is to work toward a confession. And if that's the way this is in fact used, I think that is probably an improper use in an employment setting. The next thing that I heard two different, as Andrea has indicated, two different kind of statements. One is, well, yes, we would use a standardized, and you saw the standardized with some of the questions that came into question. And then I heard one of the other people that was proposing the bill say, well, no, we would ask some questions based upon some other questions that may have come up on the application, you know, a variety of different things. I think that's very troublesome to us. You know, I thought about if somebody were going to ask me a question, and I'll take this opportunity to confess in front of you right now. When I was 6 years old, I took a 2-cent squirt gun from a 5 and dime. You know, so I feel much better about that now. But
I took a Pez candy dispenser when I was about 7, and I got in big trouble from my mom and the shopkeeper. I had to sweep the floor of the store for a week.
And
so there we are, self-incrimination.
Our lawyer's getting nervous again, Senator Walker.
I think you should arrest them both. Yeah, statute of limitations.
Just run. I will point out.
They're easy to confess now.
I will not be confessing anymore.
My story is very similar to yours. My father was a school principal, and confessed to him, and he made me go back, not only pay, but, you know, pay amends.
You never stole again.
And never stole again, and I've never lied to a legislator.
Thank you.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Let's hook this boy up, see about that.
But again, that was my thought, was, is there a standardized test? Does somebody know what, in fact, they're going to be asked. And this bill doesn't go there. It doesn't say there will be a statewide standardized test. These are the questions going to be on it. It's going to be up to each jurisdiction. It's also up to each jurisdiction at what point in the process they're going to apply that test. The other thing that concerned me, and Andrea did touch upon it, is the language on page 2, lines 16 through 21, and then it appears again on page 3. And if you read that, I don't know how anyone could ever prove one way or the other whether or not a polygraph was the sole basis for your not being hired. I tell you, I've been in and out of a number of jobs. I worked my way through college, and, you know, I've had various jobs. I don't know that I've ever been told why I was turned down for a job. So there is absolutely no basis for an employer to say, well, yeah, we turned you down based upon the polygraph. They will find some other excuse or some other reason. There's no way that this language would ever come into play in an employment setting or a case with unlawful employment practices. I think it gives a false sense that there's some protection here for the employees, when in fact it's not there. You know, I could not envision an employer volunteering the reason why, in any case, why you weren't hired. The next comment that I have is, and you've heard it, potential officers already go through anywhere from 6 months to a year. Psychological testing, physical testing, a variety of different things, you know, whether it's a city, a sheriff, other law enforcement, whether it's the FBI, and I have had friends, I've got friends that I represent, and they tell me it is very intense. The psychological testing, the physical testing, the interviews with family, the interviews with friends, associates, other people, it is, in fact, intense. I don't know what else they're going to find other than what was portrayed to you is deception. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm troubled by this bill, and hopefully I'm not rambling too much. But if we start down this path, and it's due solely on the fact that these folks are police officers, then where do we go? There are a number of other jobs in this state that we, in fact, entrust civil servants and employees to do the right thing, not be a child molester, a whole variety of things. Do we stop here? Do we go to teachers? Do we go to all child care workers and say, you'll have to take a polygraph? I don't know where it ends if we start down this path. The last comment that I would make is that you heard that this is the practice in other states, and quite frankly, I wasn't aware of that. And it's a method to weed out the bad apples. Well, I'm sorry, but other states have bad apples. This doesn't weed out the bad apples. Other states, there's very high-profile cases in other states in which, you know, it was somebody doing something as a police officer that was wrong. And again, it's a very, very small percent. But you are not going to catch those folks via this process. And with that, I would really strongly urge you not to pass this bill out of committee. We think it's a very, very bad idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Walker.
Well, Mr. Lashman raised, and I'm sorry I missed Andrea's testimony, but he raised a lot of the questions that I had in my mind, and you came up with one yourself, Madam Chair, right out of the box, which was, you know, you say that you can't use the basis of failing the polygraph as a way to not hire you, but how do you know? And how do you know it wasn't that reason or something else? And I'm as troubled by some of these questions as Mr. DeLashmet seems to be, because some of them don't seem to make sense, though some psychologists probably put them together and thought that they'd have some recommendation. But let me ask you this. What about the Captain Swenson was talking about the two very offensive police officers that rocked our community. It was very sad what happened. It was tragic for the women who were the victims. It was tragic for our community because they lost faith in our police department and they've had to rebuild that faith. Do you think, as the captain indicated in his testimony that had they been given a polygraph, they would have been able to ferret out this, or do you think that would have come in a psychological exam?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, without knowing the specifics of that case and just reading what I read in the newspaper, I don't know that I can fully and completely answer that question. It's my understanding it was around some sexual allegations. I'm not sure in a polygraph, and you heard, well, you did not hear Andrea's testimony, that in a pre-employment polygraph that you're going to catch that kind of incident. I don't know that somebody who is an adult, in fact, has some kind of a sexual or inappropriate sexual relationship with an adult or a minor is going to have something in their background when they were 9 years old or 8 years old that is going to all of a sudden the lights are going to go off and you go, oh, this is going to be a problem as a police officer when he's 30 years old or 25 years old. But I can't answer the specifics of the Eugene case. I just don't know.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I'm sorry you missed my testimony, Senator Walker, but I did the document that you've got in front of you, the executive summary of the National Academies of Science, I would urge you to read. It basically did a review of the scientific studies, often which were relied upon. We didn't hear a lot about them today, but often when we hear about polygraphs, it's the scientific studies show that this is extremely accurate science now. And this review suggests that that's clearly false, and that particularly with pre-employment, there are not good studies. It does not show it's reliable, and it potentially will most likely target socially stigmatized groups. So I urge you to review that study because most of my testimony came from it.
Okay.
And that summary.
Okay. Thank you.
And if I may, Madam Chair, just going down through, if this was the standard polygraph test, there are several on here that would apply to me. And would I divulge them? Probably. But then the fact that there's even a discussion about whether I was an assigned risk auto insurance. Well, yeah, I had a couple accidents when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then all of a sudden the employer knows that you had some driving problems when you're 16 years old. Well, is that going to be something that's then going to be used? Because officers then have to do high-risk driving exercises, and they get trained for that. But there are bits and pieces all the way through here, including the workers' comp piece, that concern me very much. Can somebody not use technically the polygraph, but the asking of that question, and you, in fact, did have a workers' comp claim in the past, I think one is a violation of the federal statutes as far as
ADA.
But it would be very hard to prove. I mean, you're divulging that information.
Let me ask you this. Would you feel more comfortable with this if the permissible questions were limited to criminal arrests or convictions in a person's background?
Madam Chair, they can already find that out by just running a criminal backgrounds check.
Sometimes.
They're not going to get anything else out.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Chair Burdick, right. I mean, with the discussions we had in previous sessions and in this session on the use of fingerprint background checks, the FBI ones where you can now get nationwide, as Mr. Glashman rightly said, I have seen that expand over the last 20 years in this legislature, so that almost every person who gets a license in this state or is an employee of the state or a vendor or contractor with any agency is now getting an FBI fingerprint background check. You pass this, you will open the door, and the arguments will be made that there's safety and concerns. The fingerprint check at least is scientifically sound. It's admissible in court, although apparently sometimes the FBI can't get it right, as Mr. Mayfield will attest. But what I have suggested and what the science of this shows is this technology is not scientifically sound. It's not even admissible in court in many states. And so we're going down a dangerous path by relying on a science that the scientists say is not yet accurate. And you're talking about deception and honesty and trying to find out the answers. It's an extremely gray area. I would worry about what someone might feel that they need to share or tell or disclose if questions are asked that would violate the law, but they must defend themselves because they've somehow been perceived as being deceptive. just, this is very alarming to us, and it will open the door if we pass this session. I feel very secure on that, unfortunately, these days.
Senator Pazinski?
Yeah, a couple of, I guess, questions / statements. Isn't it true that private employers in the state can, in fact, use polygraph for their pre-employment practices?
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazinski, I love the way you frame it. Isn't it true?
We're already out of time. Yes or no? They do or they don't?
I believe the statutes, the laws do not prohibit it because we treat what the public, the rights of the public sector in terms of searches or other things differently than the private sector does, unfortunately. We don't like that.
I didn't say you did, but
and if they use it, it does not make the science any better in the private sector to protect them.
The answer to that, yes.
I believe, my answer is I believe so. There's no statute that would.
The other question is there's been concern as to documentation. I mean, I would assume, Brian, in your capacity, you know that whenever a public employer takes any sanctions about anybody that's employed, and you would have to assume in pre-appointment, they're going to document what the reasons are, because if they don't, they potentially open themselves up for some type of action as being alleged that they were discriminated against. And so wouldn't it make sense that if someone was going through the application process and they were being denied employment in the public sector, they would document on what basis they did that so they could cover themselves if someone came back and said, we were wrongly discriminated against in your hiring practice?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazinski, I understand what you're asking me. I'm not sure that the documentation, in fact, is clear and is enough to be able to do an unfair employment practice case against the employer, because they could have any variety of reasons in that documentation and, in fact, not list the polygraph as one of the reasons. It could be that, they were slightly overweight, or they were, any variety of reasons that an employer might use or choose to use as the actual excuse for not hiring somebody versus the polygraph.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazinski, but I heard testimony from, I believe, Eugene and folks basically saying if someone shows that they're deceptive and we learn that they're a liar as a result of this, we're not going to hire them. So I'm a little surprised about the language in this here, because it suggests it is a primary tool to determine a lot of factors that will determine employment. Either that they were deceptive, and in and of itself being deceptive is not something we want, or they failed to disclose something that we learned from the polygraph, and we don't want to hire them for that. So,
okay, thanks. We're out of time, so we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 732. And Senator Pazinski, we're not going to have time for 3:45. Do you want it moved to Monday?
That'd
or
be
do
wonderful.
You want
it?
Okay,
thank
Senator
you.
Bill 3:45 will be moved to Monday, and we are adjourned.